Today is the fifth and last day of the May-June 5-day retreat in England. Few people have reminded me of things I have read but not responded to yet. So I picked out all the questions or comments that haven't been gone into and wrote down a few more, and we'll see how far we get with it in this approximate hour. In the so-called selfless mode, being without a self, as so many religions stress, wouldn't one lose one's personality? How would my wife relate to me if I were in that state? Would I ever say, "Oh, what a beautiful sunset," anymore to someone with me? Do you, Tony, still have a personality? I would warn against all image making of Tony. Let's meet each other as we are and not conjecture of whether she has personality or not. I do. See, this is the amazing thing of thought. Hearing about something like a state of selflessness and then trying to figure it out, imagine it, speculate about it. And not only come up with speculations like losing personality or whatever, but then also scaring oneself with these speculations. There would be emptiness, there would be a void, I've heard that word too. What a horrible thought, a walking void. What would my wife talk to? Would she leave me? Would she leave the walking void? So to watch, with humor, as we're doing right now, what thought does. If there is no insight into a state in which self-reflection is quiet, then why speculate about it? We do it. So can we trace and become aware of this movement of speculation in the mind and what it does? Projections, imaginations, fantasies, and then the feedback again upon the body of what the speculation says. And the other question enclosed in this one was, would I still say, "Oh, what a lovely flower, a beautiful sunset," to someone who's with me? Because in that state of selflessness, one doesn't name things anymore. It's another idea. Maybe if two people together watch the sunset, there won't be any verbal expression of it, and yet there is seeing it without a sense of division either between you and me or the sunset and us. Or there may be the fullness of expression about it, because we are standing there together and we like to communicate with each other. Human beings love communicating with each other, particularly in the presence of something beautiful. And it may be quite clear that the word beautiful sunset is not this thing happening, which cannot be captured by any words. And do the words and wallowing in the emotional content of the words prevent one from further experiencing the sunset? That is something to watch. We can watch everything. Does it become divisive, isolating? Does one slip back into the video chamber, just thinking about sunset because I'm talking about it in such glowing terms? Or do the words communicate with my partner, my friend, but don't detract. Don't come in between this marvelous happening. And in a state of open looking and wondering and listening, words become transparent. They are not eradicated from the mind or thoughts. But it is quite clear that the thought or word is not what is actually going on. Can you say something about reincarnation? A close friend committed suicide, and it helps me to think that in another life, she will have another chance. What do you, Tony, say about reincarnation? Good question again. Why do you want to hear from me about this? But we are interested in hearing other people's opinions or maybe experiences. And can one listen to what somebody says without putting extra weight on it? This whole thing of authority that we've talked about. Tony or XYZ saying something must be more weighty than ABC saying something. When I first entered into this whole world of Eastern religion, Buddhism, Zen Buddhism, having first read about it, I was very fascinated, attracted by the thought of rebirth. In Buddhism, it's really called rebirth. Reincarnation is what it's called in Hinduism. And in reflecting upon it later, I realized the greatest attraction of it was that it was dampening the fear of dying. It was something to look forward to, and of course we always think we'll have a better life. At least we hope that our friend will have a chance, a better chance than in this life. So for a while I could lay to rest the fear of dying, because I'll be reborn. And I think many people who became interested in Eastern religion at that time had similar feelings, similar attractions, and similar results of listening to this. Something made more sense, you know, that this life is not just this life, but it has a continuity of development, of advancement, of reaching higher and higher and higher stages of development, eventually merging with the all, or becoming fully, perfectly, totally enlightened. And as we have talked repeatedly about in this retreat, goals, imagined states of being, have a powerful effect upon this body. Thoughts trigger chemicals which trigger organ function, and stimulation, energies are aroused. Depression may transfer into elation and so forth, just with an inspiring thought. And I became more and more interested in looking at this rather than just being caught up in the content of thoughts and theories and beliefs, to see what effect do they have? What are they really? What is a belief? Not the content, but as far as this mind is concerned, and this body, and then our interrelationship with each other. I personally have had no recollections whatsoever of previous lives or future lives. And I'm not interested in it either. I think an intense interest in it will bring up all kinds of stuff in this consciousness, which, as we talked about also, contains the memory of all humankind, collectively, consciously, unconsciously, subconsciously stored in this consciousness. That to me is no doubt about it. Also from observing memories coming up, which seem to have no connection with any personal experience. I had a lot of those when I studied Tsege Jung. It's interesting. You study somebody and all of a sudden your dreams change. They were different when I studied Freud. I had different dreams. Maybe both of them some significance, but I was interested also in dreaming what one was almost supposed to dream. But there were sometimes elements which, in also studying some mythology, I with interest found that there were some mythological themes that I had no personal contact with that I could remember. But it is also quite clear that as we live from moment to moment, day to day, week to week, year to year, or decade to decade, our previous states or looks or what we were at that time is now memory, isn't it? It's not, I'm no longer what I remember that I was when I was a 4-year-old girl or 14-year-old teenager, a young woman in her 20s. A change is going on in us, which at the time we're right there, we don't realize our changes, but later on, reflecting upon it, we can say, this was then and now I'm like this, I have changed. Different new thought systems, maybe new beliefs, new assumptions, new experiences. New learnings and education, studying things. And we assume different images about ourselves and the personality changes at least somewhat. Our capacities change over this lifetime. Don't have to go back to previous lifetimes. Where is the little girl, the baby that I don't even remember? Where is that now? It's in my memory. And if the memory comes up to, I say, I now reincarnated as a 64-year-old woman from a little baby in the crib. I can remember not being a little baby, but I can remember incidents in my early life. Has that transmigrated? It doesn't make any sense to think in those terms, but is it much different from our ideas of transmigrating from lifetime to lifetime? And can this instant be a new reincarnation, if you will, a rebirth, by seeing things freshly without the pressure of memory or the desire or fear of memory? Or is it just the same old thoughts reincarnating all the time? Maybe a moment of no reflection about myself, and then somebody says something that upsets me or hurts my feelings, and here the me is reincarnated again, if you will. It comes up again in a powerful form, fighting back or hurting or hating or withdrawing. Where a moment ago was no reflection, was quiet, a 5-day retreat. self was relative, self-reflection may have been relatively quiet, at least for moments at a time. And then it awakens again. It's reborn, reincarnating into this moment. And can one likewise look at this whole thing of lifetime to lifetime as a stream of consciousness constantly manifesting again, freshly in new human beings? Which it does, because the thought content changes over time, but thoughts, streams of thoughts or streams of consciousness does reincarnate or does manifest again in human beings. And that goes on, the stream of thought manifesting in human beings, newborn today, still with open innocent eyes. And then pretty soon the sense of me first, mine, not sharing. Some children seem to be more given to sharing than others. But what are all the circumstances surrounding that? Have the same circumstances surrounded the other child who does not share? One was the first one, firstborn one. The second one came along. The other one was already there. The sharing was already a given. My sister was the older one in the family. She tells me today, and she became a psychoanalyst, very interested in all this. She says she still has, and we have a very, very close, good relationship. But she says, deep down, she still is not done with the jealousy of this younger sister. So deep. And I didn't have that. To me, it was rather feeling inferior in the face of a sister who could do so much, who was so good in school, and so forth. It was another constellation. When our son, who was an only one, didn't have a second child, we adopted him. He played for a long time best friends with a little girl who was the third of four or five children. And she's very grabby. And they were very good companions. He loved her companionship and let her have everything that she wanted. And she had one place where she could grab everything without an older sister bopping her on the head. When they played house, they were always two fathers. She didn't want to be a mother. Two cowboys. And Ralph was happy. He was an only child, happy to have somebody to play with. Yeah, I had my toys because he had plenty. He didn't hold on to it. He didn't have competition, which I think it must be very difficult for the firstborn. To lose the place in the sun. I remember when we had Ralph, he was sitting there in his high chair next to Kyle and me, and four eyes were almost constantly on this child. What was he doing? I was just watching him. And imagine, all of a sudden, four eyes are on another baby. And this one is out in the cold and starts doing naughty things to get those four eyes back. And instead, he gets scolding and frowns back. And then he's told, share with your little sister. How did we get there? No, it came from rebirth. It came from that. So, thoughts and patterns of behavior, patterns of beliefs and whatsoever, reincarnating, if you will. But to say, if I think of something very vividly in the Middle Ages, being a princess in a towered castle, and usually people have such glamorous remembrances. Nobody says I was a charwoman thrown into a mass grave at the time of the what was it, pox or pestilence. No one has ever said that to me. It was always something dramatic, interesting. So a memory like this comes up very vividly, or this déjà vu. Somebody once told me they came to England and they knew every place of that village. What is the connection between this was me? What is this me? This was me, and now this me is me now. It's such complication. They're memories, and they manifest in human beings. And the strongest cluster of memories is the sense of me-ness, self-ness, I-ness. I want to investigate that now as it happens and not have fantasies about what I was in a former life, to entertain myself, or what I will be in a future life. My friend has taken her life and has gone through the same thing, even with close relatives. There's great pain there. And again, does the thought of her or him having another chance in another life alleviate my pain, that my need is to alleviate my pain? But one may also feel the pain of the person, a young person, not being able to see the truth or meaning of life. There's a tremendous sorrow in this. There's a tremendous amount of teenage suicides in America. I don't know about this country. Young people feeling the utter meaninglessness of life, taking their life. What will it be like in 20 years? Will we live more meaningfully, so teenagers don't have to take their life? That depends on what we do now, doesn't it? Not what we imagine we could do in the future. Can there be some insight in all of our patterned, habitual, automatic responses now as they happen? It's only if that insight happens now that it may not perpetuate and continue the next moment. If there's no insight, there is continuity, and to that we are attached. Whether we know it or not, we are attached to our continuity as individual me's. I'm interested in this continuity, seeing now what is about to continue as a conditioned response, and whether that can indeed be seen and abate in the clarity of seeing, insight, call it what you will. So that's enough about reincarnation. You have said repeatedly, I'm not going too fast. You have said repeatedly that our consciousness is not as individual as we think and feel it is. That human consciousness is an interconnected whole. That is something I can neither understand nor intuit directly. Can you say some more about this? I think it is very connected with what we were saying just previously. Actually, somebody thought this was already talking about this. What is our consciousness? Where does it come from? Who is the owner of it? We think it's mine, and I am the owner, but that needs to be examined if one is interested in not just perpetuating belief and common usage of words and concepts. And in trying to find the owner of this consciousness, the thinker of the thought, the possessor of this body, I find nothing. I only find a throbbing body, a flowing consciousness, and in that consciousness, the thought is mine. I am the thinker. That's a thought. I'm throwing it out for you to pick up and look at. Maybe it's clear to you. But it's deep belief that the thinker of thoughts is me, that there is a thinker in this consciousness. A little man or a little woman who does the thinking, or some kind of entity. But do you see how little we examine what we believe? Try to find the thinker, the owner of this body, the possessor of this consciousness. And what you will find is thoughts, ideas, beliefs, scriptures maybe that affirm it or deny it. But looking inwardly, what do we find looking inwardly? Either enormous circuits or loops and flows of thought, or if we're fortunate enough, that thought abates, slows down, becomes quiet at times, then what is there inside? A very engaging story of a Zen teacher who, as a little boy, was present at the funeral of his father. There were cakes on the altar, and he asked the priest, "For whom are those cakes?" And the priest said, "They are for your father." He said, "For my father? He's dead." The priest said, "Well, they are for the soul of your father," which fascinated the seven-year-old, however old he was, boy. What is a soul that can eat cake? If he has one or had one, I must have one too. That was a little intelligent deduction. But he didn't rest content with that. He wanted to find that soul, come upon it. All the advice he was given was, find it yourself. Don't ask me about it. So he spent long years, because we've told the story maybe a little bit to inspire us to sit long years, must always distract a little bit from the story. But in this sitting, things sort of emptied out. He was very serious about it. He didn't want to do anything else but find the soul. And sometimes people get totally absorbed with something, some idea, some goal. Scientists do it. Newton is said to have been so possessed with trying to figure out this whole gravitational thing that he boiled the egg clock and held the egg in his hand. Not totally open. But he came up with a tremendous formula which moved our minds, changed a lot of our outlook, industrial and personal and scientific. So this boy was possessed with trying to find his soul. And the more he sat, the quieter it got, he found nothing. And everything became empty like the sky. And he said, don't stop. He was now admonishing his students, don't stop with that emptiness either. You know, people find the emptiness for seconds or maybe longer periods, and then they want to hold on to it. I found it. But who is the experiencer and holder honor to this emptiness? Still me, isn't it? An idea of me having something, and the stimulating effect of that idea of having my emptiness on this body attached or addicted to the energies of that idea or of that the feelings of that emptiness. But the dual state. So if we begin to look inside, leaving alone Vasudeva, what's his name, I think, what we first find is nothing but thought. And of course, emotion. Can't stress that enough. Every thought is linked with emotions and sensations. The thought itself is not qualitatively different from what else goes on. It's a electrochemical, whatever all process in the brain and having the power to transmit chemicals to other organs and also to be stored in memory. This is what is so for all of us. The idea of being a thinker, the idea of having this body, being the owner of it and attached to our possession, maybe the owner of the soul. This is one of the most widespread beliefs, religious and otherwise, in human beings. All the historical early things, there's little intimations of depictions symbolically of the soul escaping at the time of death as a bird or some kind of symbolic thing. We share that. We share that belief and have had it hundreds of thousands of years. Where does our consciousness come from? Where do our ideas come from? They come from whoever inculcated us with them. And they got it from their parents and teachers and priests and ministers, gurus. Where did they get it from? We all draw on the same stream of ideas and beliefs. They always manifest afresh in each human being or are available through our contact with others who already have a more established system of beliefs. And how much is genetically transmitted, we don't even know. Maybe the feeling of meanness has some genetic DNA component. Who knows? No, it's not that long. Ah, it is, in a way. Because the insight into it has nothing to do with genetic determination. I'm quite sure about this. I may be wrong. It's something that comes, I know not where from. And maybe even the idea of from here to there is already off. Not to think in those terms. It's the limited way the brain thinks. So where does all our stuff come from? It comes from mummy and daddy, the inherited traits, and of course their parents and relatives. There's a big pool of stuff, genes, DNA, which always reincarnates, if you will, or manifests in each newborn baby. It's not his or hers. He didn't do it. I didn't do it. There are genetic transmissions from a pool of capabilities and features and talents, looks, characteristics of, because there's subdivided pools, some racial DNA or genetic transmission is somewhat different from another, but there is this transmission of genetic material, hereditary stuff, for all of us human beings. It's not mine. I can say it's mine, but it's just manifesting here. And after I die, where will it go? Does it again become part of that stream? A very close friend of mine just recently died a couple months ago. We were very, very close. We were over the phone. We were not together physically over the phone as she was dying of cancer. And I could literally feel her personality and characteristics ebb away. Less and less manifesting. Until in the end, her husband held the phone to her ear, I could just hear the breathing. And then that stopped one day. She's gone. Her body, she donated it to the research lab of the local university, and then to be the ashes to be strewn into water. I can remember her vividly, and if I remember the good times we had together, then that memory elicits feelings of sadness or grief. I can see the connection very clearly between the memory and the feeling. But she's gone, that's a fact. what was there to be. What happened to all her thoughts and ideas and knowledge, capacities? They had no children. Some of it lives on in things she did. Thoughts maybe that were absorbed by others. This is how we accumulate information and knowledge by contact with each other. But we all knew it. It's one process. Do you see that? And it is so in spite of the fact that not two human beings are entirely alike. That's agreed upon by all anatomists and physiologists. There is no such thing as two human beings. The odds are one in a, I don't know what, a huge number for two being entirely alike. Not so for twins, obviously. But that's true for all of us, that we're not completely alike. And yet we all remember, we all, unless we are damaged, brain damaged, and that goes for all of us, we get the brain damaged, these thought processes won't function the way they do now. But for a healthy individual, thought, storage of thought and the connections of thought with emotions, image making, and taking the images for real, and then reacting to the image and not seeing the real thing, that goes for all of us since time immemorial. We grieve, we have pleasure, we're envious or jealous. Goes for all of us. Maybe somebody at this point isn't jealous, but maybe in a different situation would be jealous. And our, of course, our physiological, anatomical functioning is so similar, albeit some variation. Are we attached to our individual uniqueness? Is that our pride and attachment? We are, aren't we? Particularly if we have some capacities and make image out of it and then attach to this image and garner physical stimulation from that image, energies, enthusiasm, or self-love, or let's rather say self-attachment. Self-adulation, all the opposite. We have negative images about ourselves. We derive negative, depressive feelings from it. But the amazing thing, having worked with many people over these years, is there's almost as strong an attachment to our negative images as there is to our positive. One just doesn't want to let go of this because this is now my existence in which I have investment as me, as me. And I can complain about it or blame others for it. Don't we see ourselves in all of this? Don't we, if we begin to look, have more space to look at other people, a little bit less involved with ourselves, don't we understand that what happens in you and him and her is what I've observed in myself? This comes by itself in doing this work. If we don't attach too much to this belief, we're all different. And therefore, as soon as we attach to belief, we're blindfolded, like the horses which pull a carriage. They get little shields on their eyes so that they don't look left or right. See that there's really grass to eat. Walk along, because they don't see anything but the gravel. That's how we are when we are attached to a belief. We don't look left or right. We just seek confirmation for our belief. And where we find confirmation there, we feel at home and undisturbed. And if the belief is challenged, either we take the challenge or we say, I don't want to have any more of that. It's too disturbing. And yet, if one has lived at times attentively with one's beliefs and reflexes and conditioned responses, one also knows the prison of that. And there's a deep yearning to be out of that prison. And then one will take in one's stride the the upset of the prison collapsing, or certain beliefs collapsing, and maybe nothing yet in its place, and the pain of it, one will stay with it because one understands the pain and restriction and limitation of living in a prison, the prison of our beliefs and thoughts, and conditioned habitual ways. And let me say one more thing about this consciousness being one. I think I've said it enough about the consciousness of thoughts and habits and history, accumulated knowledge, accumulated what have you, it all manifesting in each one of us, including our emotions which date back to the animals. There's sexual rivalry among the animals, trying to possess the female and fight the other male. There's territorialism among the animals, staking out one's territory and fighting against the intruders. Only the animals do it much simpler and get the point much quicker that this is not to be entered. They don't start hoarding ammunition and getting allies to invade this other elk's territory. They just move away. Usually bloodless. Sometimes it bleeds out of the antlers or wherever the fighting takes place. But these are patterns which antedate human development. Caring for the young. Protecting the young against danger. So see, we don't only share it with us, we share it with the animals too. We've got a little bird in the kitchen right now which was found on the crushed stone wall. It's already a member of the family. There's some mutuality. So, is there something else in which we are one, in which we're not divided, beside the stream of thoughts and habits and territorialism and rivalry, which we all share? Is there something else which is shareable on a deep level? It has happened to many people, not isolated, privileged, or distinguished personalities. It has happened to many people, some of whom very simple, either engaged in meditation, quiet, sitting, walking, listening and looking, or not engaged in any system. It has happened that the world opens up, something opens up into silence and space and the absence of division. In looking at it, examining it, one finds there's no fear in that state, no longing or desiring, and no reflection, not the habitual, constant reflection about myself. That's absent in that state which comes upon one, or one comes upon it. Any expression and words makes it dualistic, but it is not. People here have mentioned it happening, often saying, regret, almost it was so quickly gone. But let's not regret the fact that it's quickly gone, but rejoice that it happened at all to human beings. Oh, ensnared. Now, contemporary life seems to become more complicated all the time, that it is possible for to come upon that state, or its dawning, that everything is as it is, without a feeling of isolation from it or division, without fear or longing or wanting. And in no need to be judged, good or bad, right or wrong. It's what it is. Not the intellectual reflection, but the actuality of it. When that happens to you and me, there is no difference between us. That listening, that being, has no personality or limitation, borderline between you and me. Now you could make theories and say it's in all of us, all we need to do is dig for it. I don't know whether it's or it's there all the time, all we need to do is peel away layers or break through barriers or walls. You can make all kinds of theories. I don't know whether it's there all the time, but when it's there, it's there. When it's not there, we're ensnared in thought, which is the same for all of us. Do you see that? Is that different for me than for you? Of course, you may be deaf. I have a very intimate correspondence with actually a Vipassana teacher. Who's deaf? Once she writes long, long letters, and one time, the first time I said, it would be easier, maybe we'd get together and talk. She said, it wouldn't be any good because I can't hear. I have to write. But see, I haven't talked about that with her yet or written. But listening is there whether a bird is there or not, a bird is heard or not. Listening meaning the openness. All senses, every pore of the body opened as one openness, not divided into listening and seeing and touching and smelling and so forth. As one open perception, and if one sense is damaged, ear is damaged, it doesn't matter. When nothing, when it's absolutely quiet and still, there's still listening going on. The openness is not dependent on objects that can be seen, heard, touched, tasted, or smelled. If it's there, it's there, the object. If it's not there, the openness does not disappear because of the absence of object. Why do you not talk about impermanence and selflessness? Well, I have just talked quite a bit about selflessness. And maybe, I don't put it in those terms. I don't start from a concept, maybe enshrined in a religious tradition. I just look at what happens in this mind and body in our interrelationship and alone. I would not just posit this state of selflessness as something that is the summum bonum, something we should achieve. It creates or perpetuates all the mischief we're capable of. To try to get that, have that, attain it. We talked about that previously, and a lot of people have had an insight about that. But what does it mean to be selfless? Let's look at it since it came up again. Does it mean imposing precepts upon myself to be selfless, vowing to be unselfish, vowing to be compassionate, taking precepts to save, what did we say, every day, our vow to become enlightened, to save all sentient beings or something like that? So preposterous at the time to me. Couldn't make peace with that one. So what if we put that aside, all the ideas and the resolutions to get it and the vows and the precepts, what does it mean to be selfless, unself-centered, or unself-conscious? Are you looking? Doesn't it mean that thought, with its emotions, emotional connections and memory connections, doesn't constantly revolve around this idea and sense of me, constantly reflecting about myself, including reflecting that I should be a better self, that's also revolving around myself, that this process of self-reflection, which is programmed into the human brain, it's not a bad, blameworthy thing, it's programmed into the brain. We have that capacity to reflect upon ourselves. Animals, as far as is known, don't have that. That's why they live more simply, less self-centeredly, if you will. Less in war, they don't have wars. Hatred, torture. It's just a very simple way of describing it. The reflex, the programmed reflex of constantly checking up on oneself, thinking about oneself, how am I doing? That quiets down. The energy does not flow into that loop, which is a considerable loop. The energy is gathering and listening and looking what's there, inwardly, outwardly. See, constant self-reflection, maybe shut down for an instant or for longer periods of time. One person I've read about claims it's shut down for good. I can't believe that, and it doesn't bother me that she says it. Just observe what happens here in this laboratory, if you will, observing in oneself, that when there is less or no reflection about oneself, it has lost its attraction to over years of observing it and all the pain that it brings in addition to some pleasure, all the separation, alienation, and it's not so important. The body doesn't need to constantly suck energies from this thinking about oneself. If that becomes clearer, more transparent, then there's space to be in touch with what is, not in relationship to self-reflection, but as it is. And in that space, there may be the emergence of compassion, which is not an intention, a vow, a practice, but it comes because it's so clear what sorrow we human beings are inundated with. One has understood it in oneself and one can touch it in others. Can the self-reflective process, reflex, if you will, become transparent at times, that one really sees that it's going on? And if there's not too much pleasure invested in it that wants to continue, then maybe, see, the energy will flow out of it into awareness. Of listening, looking, being here. Not as a somebody who needs to constantly get attention and praise or expecting blame. Just as a human being, for that time free from the prison constantly having to think about oneself. And it's not a moral thing, it's not a resolution. It happens on its own when it becomes transparent. And sometimes it shuts down. One knows not why or how or where from. It just isn't there. And the world looks different. Beautiful. Bright. Not threatening. And the ugly, I know I shouldn't just say it looks beautiful, the ugly is seen for what it is, not with condemnation, with blame, finger pointing, but with a depth of understanding for the sorrow in which we live, for the sorrow we create, or which is created through all this capacity of an evolving consciousness, which includes such capacity for thought, image making, retention of memory. And what about impermanence? I also, it's just last year in Germany, the same question came up. Somebody said, I was at a conference, it was an Eastern religion, and there was talk about impermanence, and it was so inspiring to hear about impermanence. Why don't you sometime talk about impermanence? Well, I can't do everything, hold a conference and have a retreat. But we did have a talk on impermanence, at least part of the talk. See, I never start from a concept. I look at what's going on. If one wants to hear about impermanence, why? Can I throw the question back at you? Is that like the other person who felt such inspiration hearing that all change is all, is everything is impermanent, that one gets some comfort out of it, particularly if one's present situation is discomforting, distressing? Then to hear that everything is impermanent can give one a comfort, well, this will pass too. And hearing about it relieves the distress. I have actually looked very carefully, and still doing it, we can do it right now, into this whole concept of impermanence and how much thought is needed to create it and maintain it. That when thought is not moving, are you listening? When thought is not moving, there is no concept of impermanence. Then, right now remembering arriving in Sweden, the leaves were out a little bit and then going up north. The leaves weren't out yet. But every day looking at the branch, there was first a little green tip, then this little tiny, you've looked at tiny leaves, haven't you? Everything is already there. Nothing is missing. It's like in a little baby. Next day, there is this leaf. Next day, there is this. There, next day is this. And if thought does not connect it through memory, how it was when I arrived, and stringing it all together, and then seeing the tiny bud turned or changed into a larger and now quite large leaf, if that thought process accessing memory does not operate, then every day is just what is. It's neither permanent nor impermanent. It's just there. And if I don't project into the future, oh, this leaf, pretty soon it'll be fully grown, and then it may get dusty. The green won't be so bright. The gloss will be gone because there'll be dust from the road. And then come fall, it will turn into red or yellow or orange. If I don't think of all of that and project it, then it's just this now. Not changing into something else. That needs thought. And then I'm not saying we shouldn't think in those terms. I'm not saying that. But it needs thought to talk about impermanence. Other than that, this is just what is. From moment to moment, anew. Sometimes you say, oh, this is just a thought. Isn't thought also real? Of course it's real. Has the reality of, I think we talked about this today, the reality of a physiological, electrical, chemical process. It's the content of thought, what it says. Saying that you're bad because you've got black skin or you're liable to be a drug dealer. Because he's got a beard or look in a certain way. Then thought is not real. The process is real, but what the content projects is an illusion. Is that clear? The last question is, do you, Tony, pray? Can you say something about that? I used to pray as a little child to be protected by the angel, not to be bombed out, my parents not to be taken away to concentration camp. I prayed to a God that I was afraid of, I told you that. But the angel seemed to be sort of an intermediary. One time, I was alone, I was 5 years old, alone put on a train. The story was that I had wanted to go to school because my sister was in school. I also wanted to do that. Couldn't go in school in the state in which I lived, so I had to be in Prussia. Saxony didn't allow it, Prussia allowed it, so I was about an hour away by train. We had friends there, and they put me into a school there for 2 months, and I suffered intensely being away from home. But every 2 weeks or so, I was put on a train to go home to visit my family. And one time, there was an announcement that the carriage in which I was sitting was going to be disconnected at the next station, and people from that carriage should go to another carriage. I was absolutely paralyzed with fear that I would get stuck in this carriage, not know how to get to the other carriage, and never get home again. And I prayed very intensely to God to not let me get stuck in this carriage. Get me out of here somehow. Help me. And there was a man across me. And at one point he said, little girl, where are you going? I said, I'm going to Leipzig, but blah, blah, blah. Oh, he says, you have to change carriages. Come with me at the next station. And he took me by the hand and got me to the other. Of course, I was convinced my prayer had been heard. Today I don't pray anymore. I don't condemn it when people pray. I don't tell them, don't pray, it's nonsense. I don't say those things. But I have nothing or no one to pray to. Things aren't this way anymore. Me, the helpless little child, and a great father hopefully watching over me. Actually, this was very much shattered, this belief, with all the bombings and horrible things that I witnessed in Germany. The belief in the caring father and the power of him or his son was shattered, because anybody with any love could not let this happen. This to me was very clear. Sasri belief in that was shattered and there was no one to pray to. Today, I'm just asking people who are praying, are you praying for yourself to get things? As in my case, something happened. I was taken out of the carriage. What do you pray for? For peace? For love to reign over this earth, which is so without love? Do you pray for people to put down their arms? Stop polluting the earth, stop cutting down trees, whatever, is that what we pray for? Hoping that the prayer, and if maybe we get together in prayer, it will be more effective. Maybe it will be, maybe there will be some effect from the combined energies of prayer. The Catholics do it, the Tibetans, the Dalai Lama prays, I think, with people. Accumulations of people praying together, maybe it has some effect, a little effect, like maybe a snowflake falling on a hot pavement. But do we understand why we hate? Do we understand the absence of love? Do we look into ourselves? Because we're not disconnected from this whole happening on this earth, in this universe. At that moment, the need for prayer turns into the need for looking and listening, inwardly and outwardly, with a growing intelligence. So we don't have to blame or shoot or hate, but can understand. And compassion arise out of this understanding. We will end here for today.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.